This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Dana and Charisse are sisters who love their dad. But because of him, they've never met. Their father is a bigamist. Charisse and Dana have been raised by separate mothers in the same city. Dana knows about her father's other family. Charisse does not. But all of that is about to change. And so begins the story of Silver Sparrow, the latest novel by Tayari Jones. In it, the sisters meet and develop a loving relationship and a friendship, and it is, however, shadowed by a painful secret. Author Tayari Jones set the novel in Atlanta, Georgia in the 1980s, but she's here with us now in North Carolina, and it is my pleasure to welcome her to The State of Things. Tayari Jones, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. You created a unique kind of extended family in this novel. Where did the idea for Silver Sparrow come from?
Well, I feel I should start and tell you where it didn't come from. My father is not a bigamist.
Do you have to start every interview that way?
I've said that every day for the last year. But I will say this, like many people, I have sisters, and we have the same father, but we don't have the same mother. They were born before my parents ever met. But still, there was always for me this sense that I had sisters that I could not quite access. And I came to realize that usually when we think of custody battles, we think of which parents get custody of the children. But I didn't realize that children also have custody of the parents. Like, I grew up with custody of my father, and my sisters did not. And so that is what actually got my mind working on this idea.
Let's talk about the book, because the idea of bigamy itself does shock most Americans. The fact that these two families existed in the same city, I think, gives it deeper meaning, the idea that they could always have discovered each other. What was challenging for you? You said, I'm not the daughter of a bigamist. What was challenging about creating a bigamist at the center of this story?
You know, I didn't think of it so much as a story about bigamy as much as a story about sisters. And that is the place from which I could access this story. Because since the main characters are, in fact, the daughters, their relationships are what were more important to me. And that's kind of how I walked into it. Bigamy is kind of shocking because in Silver Sparrow, the father actually does marry both women. And something about just that formality of marriage becomes shocking. But the idea of secret families, while shocking, is not unfamiliar.
James Witherspoon is that father. But again, you could have made him the father of both without, similar to your situation and many, many others. But there was something about that formality. Why is that important to this novel?
Well, I think the formality of the marriage was important to the second wife, Gwen. She really wanted her daughter to have equal footing with James's daughter from his marriage. And so therefore, she wanted to be a wife too. As she says, it matters what you call things.
It does. And that, I think, is what the book shines a light on, that these relationships and the names that we give these relationships shape our identity in ways that we don't think about. When I say my wife and my daughter, that's a kind of possessive, and it creates a relationship. It changes who I think I am.
I think definitely the person who is called my wife or is called my daughter enjoys a certain privilege, but it's invisible. They never think about what it means. It's only the people that don't have the luxury of title that understand the significance of titles.
Tell us about these daughters, Dana and Charisse.
Well, Dana is, she's an interesting girl. She's smart. She's ambitious. I think much of her mother's ambition for her is compensating for this fact that she is the unacknowledged daughter. And so she wants to go to Mount Holyoke because she thinks that is the place where dreams come true, where you have all the opportunity in the world to make your life whatever you want. Charisse, the daughter who lives in the open, she has no idea that almost everything she enjoys is at the expense of someone else. She thinks of herself as just an ordinary high school kid, you know, with problems of not being invited to parties or being too much in the shadow of her mother. She works a lot of hours in her mother's hair salon. And she too, both these girls are dying to become women. They want to become women, but just not like their mothers.
And there's a wonderful moment in the book too where Dana, who knows all along about their relationship and their father, kind of makes her way into the Witherspoon household and then is really kind of checking things out to see who's got the better appliances.
Better appliances, better everything.
Yeah.
You know, she's always been told, do not cross this line. You must never get in contact with your father's real family. And they're right there in the same city of Atlanta. They see each other all the time. I cannot imagine a teenager who would not dare just take a little peek. If someone says to you, you can look inside this household that you've heard about all your life and just see what's in there, how could she resist?
And to make the comparisons as well. Would you read for us?
Okay, I'll read a few pages from the start of the book. Mm-hmm. This is in the voice of Dana. Chapter 1, The Secret. My father, James Witherspoon, is a bigamist. He was already married 10 years when he first clamped eyes on my mother. In 1968, she was working at the gift wrap counter at Davison's downtown when my father asked her to wrap the carving knife he had bought his wife for their wedding anniversary. Mother says that she knew that something wasn't right between a man and a woman when the gift was a blade. I said that maybe that means there was some kind of trust between them. I love my mother, but we tend to see things a little bit differently. The point is that James's marriage was never hidden from us. James is what I call him. His other daughter, Charisse, the one who grew up in the house with him, she calls him Daddy even now. When most people think of bigamy, if they think of it at all, they imagine some primitive practice taking place on the pages of National Geographic. In Atlanta, we remember one sect of the Back to Africa movement that used to run bakeries in the West End. Some people said it was a cult. Others call it a cultural movement. Whatever it was, it involved four wives for each husband. The bakeries have since closed down, but sometimes we still see the women, resplendent in white, trailing six humble paces behind their mutual husband. Even in Baptist churches, ushers keep smelling salts on the ready for the new widow confronted at the wake by the other grieving widow and her stair-step kids. Undertakers and judges know that it happens all the time, and not just between religious fanatics, traveling salesmen, handsome sociopaths, and desperate women. It's a shame that there isn't a true name for a woman like my mother. My father, James, is a bigamist. That's what he is. Laverne is his wife. She found him first, and my mother has always respected the other woman's squatter's rights. But was my mother his wife, too? She has legal documents and even a single Polaroid proving that she stood with James Alexander Witherspoon, Jr. in front of a judge just over the state line in Alabama. However, to call her only his wife doesn't really explain the full complexity of her position.
Tayari Jones reading from her new novel, Silver Sparrow. She's going to read tonight in Chapel Hill at Flyleaf Books at 7:30. She is here now. You must have thought about this, and it's, I think, illustrated in that passage, how we all know these stories. They're very common, and yet we refuse to name them, and we pretend that they don't exist. What is it about the structure, the kind of rule that you must have one wife, one family, you know, and one family must live under the same roof, honored in the breach? Why is it that we can't sort of break the rule?
You know, I think that this question of secret families and unacknowledged paternity is actually the bedrock of Western literature. If you think about it, the Greek myths, it's all about Zeus having these outside children and the wrath of his wife. In the African-American literary tradition, that is what the slave narrative is all about. It's Frederick Douglass saying, I am the son of this plantation, yet not the heir of this plantation. And I think it really is about this, about being heirs, about transferring wealth down the official line of lineage. But if you notice, when you see these stories about secret children, the famous stories are all about sons, because that's how wealth is passed down. Mm. There are very few stories about daughters.
Well, property ownership and how it's transferred, not only the wealth, the material wealth that's generated on by the property, but women and children as property.
Yes.
And passed on, and all that's the structure that would be broken if we speak truth to the lie. This is how we live our lives. This is who we really are.
Exactly. And who people want to acknowledge as their children on paper, because when people come together in a marriage, that's two families coming together to make another family. So this is like the child of record.
You know, in the book, you divide the story in an interesting way, and I love the way you did it. So Dana's story is told first, then Charisse, you didn't alternate their stories. It had a particular effect, but I want to hear why, what you had in mind when you did it that way.
Well, I don't outline my novels before I write them. I write in order to find the story. And my idea actually was to write it all from the point of view of Dana. But I realized that Dana, as the secret child, has no access to the full story. That I needed a spy, if you will, a narrator, a reporter from the other side of the wall. And I had to decide of all the people who live on that other side of the wall, who would be the best one to tell that story. And that would be Charisse. The reason I chose not to alternate the chapters, Dana, then Charisse, is that for the first half of the story, Charisse has nothing to tell. As Dana says, Charisse was under the impression that hers was an ordinary life. So it's not until Dana kind of, as she says, bulls her china shop, that she has an interesting story to tell.
And she kind of bulls her narrative as well. So she intrudes or becomes part of the narrative and begins to upset Charisse's thinking in that passage, where Dana had a more or less uninterrupted run in her narrative. It's a very interesting technique and effect to have Charisse sort of right before our eyes be shaken by the presence of the sister she never knew.
It's an interesting thing because as a reader, we know more than Charisse. So Charisse says, I met this really fascinating girl. And the reader is like, oh, it's so much more fascinating than you know, young lady.
Right. And of course, it develops more and more over time. And once Charisse finds out, becomes very interesting indeed all the way through. Now, would you say the other interesting thing about this book is that it presents black middle class families? Would you say they're underrepresented in this in fiction in general these days?
I don't know how we would go about measuring it, but I do think that there is a tendency in African American fiction, and I'm going to say what is published because I feel that you never know what people are writing. You only know what's published or what's publicized. But I do think there is this interest in stories from what I call the poles of life, like I say, Princeton or the projects, the Hamptons or the hood, like this kind of idea of an extreme black experience. You know, so you have writers who've written really excellent books like Sapphire's Push, which is, you know, about extreme poverty and suffering, or narratives, I call them, where there's, for example, Colson Whitehead's excellent Sag Harbor about African-American families summering on the Hamptons. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of interested in that experience right down the middle, more of just kind of an everydayness of life, not so much of a spectacle of like, did you know black people do XYZ thing? Yeah. Instead, just a family.
The title, Silver Sparrow, does it have anything to do with the gospel tune, Eyes on the Sparrow?
Oh, indeed. Actually, I chose, it's a title that comes from two tunes. Silver is actually a reference to Bridge Over Troubled Water, a song that I so loved when I was a girl. And there's a refrain where the singer says, sail on, silver girl, all your dreams are on their way. And I always thought, what a lucky girl that is, when I was a child. So that stuck in my head. And then His Eyes on the Sparrow, with the sparrow being the least, you know, what you have done unto the least of these, you have done unto me, you know, from the gospel. So I felt that this was Dana because she's so beautiful and so arresting that she is a silver girl, but she is also a sparrow.
Well, tell us what a silver girl is. What does that mean?
A silver girl to Charisse is a girl, first, when you're a teenager and a girl, no matter how lovely or not lovely you are, you're always aware of another girl that you think is a whole different class of human being from you. And in Charisse's mind, these are the silver girls who have natural beauty, but also augmented beauty, what she calls pretty out of a jar. And these are the girls that have both. And so when she meets Dana, she thinks, this is the silverest girl I've ever seen.
What I think the story sheds light on, too, is this phenomenon in our own consciousness, the fact that we have so much. Dana is beautiful, and every time she encounters somebody, we encounter her beauty over and over again, and yet she feels this loss. The idea of comparing the appliances, that her relationship really does make her think deeply about who she is and can actually shake her confidence in who she is, essentially, because of a relationship that she can't control.
Well, yes, she is beautiful, and she and her mother do not doubt their beauty, but they also understand there's more to a life than beauty. I think a lot of times when women are beautiful and unhappy, it's seen as so ironic because beauty is constructed culturally as the pinnacle for women. Like, but she's beautiful. How can she be unhappy? Well, you could be poor. You can be unacknowledged by your father. I mean, there's so many other things. Their beauty is the one little piece of privilege that they have, and they know it, and they use it as best they can. But I think that to Charisse, she thinks, oh, well, Dana's beautiful. She must have no problems. But Dana's wiser than Charisse.
This is your third novel, and it is the third one set in Atlanta, Georgia. You like that place, huh? Good place to set a novel?
It's my natural habitat. I think the urban South is a great place to set a novel. Now, that is a setting that I do think is underrepresented in literature. I think that when you're a Southern writer, there's an expectation of a rural setting. Someone once said, you know, grandmothers and mules. And I would add big hats. And so I felt like the South that I know, Atlanta is totally Southern, Southern as a biscuit, if you will, but there are no mules. And so I wanted to write about, you know, communities that are changing, the demographics of the South are changing, the landscape itself is changing. And I really think it's important that our Southern literature reflect our complex and modern Southern lives.
It's a wonderful book, Tayari. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tayari Jones' latest novel, Silver Sparrow, she reads tonight, Flyleaf Books, Chapel Hill, 7:30. And then on Friday, she's going to be at Farrington Village for a lunch reception at McIntyre's Books. That starts at noon. And you can visit her at tayarijones.com for more information. That's our program. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Stella Strawmeyer is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director, back from Texas finally. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.